deputy brought in another body waiting to be shipped up to the county morgue. The last time, it had been Penny Drager. Her long, silky, black hair fouled and matted with dirt and snow. Hardesty had lost track of time since the discovery of Jim Hardy's and Mrs. Barnes's bodies, and the beginning of the heavy snow, but he thought that Penny Drager must have come in at least 2 days ago. That door had stayed locked ever since. But now it was open, open to its fullest extent, as if one of the bodies back there had strolled out, seen him sleeping with his head on his cheek, and turned around to go back to its cell and its sheet. He walked past the file cabinets, and his battered desk to the door, swung it back and forth reflectively for a moment, and then went through to the corridor which led to the cells. Here stood a tall metal door which he had not touched since leaving the Drager girl's body, and it, too, was unlocked.
"Jesus H. Christ," Hardesty said. For while the deputies had keys to the first door, only he had the key to this, and he had not even looked at the metal door for 2 days. He took the big key from the ring which hung beside his holster, fitted into the slot, and heard the mechanism clicking shut, driving the bolt. He looked for the key for a second, as if trying to see if it would open the door by itself, and then experimented by unlocking it. Difficult as ever, the key taking a lot of pressure before it would move. He began to pull the door open, almost afraid to look behind it to the cells. He remembered the screwball story Sears James and Ricky Hawthorne had tried to tell him, something out of Clark Mulligan's horror movies. A smokescreen, for whatever they really knew, a thing you'd have to be crazy to believe. If they had been younger, he would have swung on both of them. They were ridiculing him, hiding something, if they weren't lawyers. He heard a noise from the cells. Hardesty yanked at the door and stepped through onto the narrow concrete walkway between the utility cells. Even in the darkness, the air seemed full of some dirty pink light, hazy and very faint. The bodies lay beneath their sheets, mummies, in a museum. He could not have heard a noise, not possibly, unless he had heard the jail itself creaking. He realized that he was frightened and detested himself for it. He couldn't even tell who most of them were anymore. There were so many of them, so many sheet-covered bodies. But the corpses in the first cell on his right, he knew, were Jim Hardy and Mrs. Barnes, and those two were never going to make any more noise again, ever. He looked into their cell through the bars. Their bodies were on the hard floor beneath the cot against the far wall, two still white forms. Nothing wrong there. Wait a second, he thought, trying to remember the day he had put them in the cell. Didn't he put Mrs. Barnes on top of the bunk? He was almost certain. He peered in at them. Now wait, now just hold it up a minute here, he thought, and even in the cold of the unheated cells began to sweat. A white-covered little parcel that could only be the Griffin baby, frozen to death in his own bed, lay on the cot. Now, just wait a goddamn second, he said. That can't be.
He'd put the Griffin baby with D'Souza in a cell on the other side of the corridor. What he wanted to do was lock the doors behind him again and open a fresh bottle.
Get out of this place right away.
But he pushed open the cell door and stepped in. There had to be some explanation. One of the deputies had come back here and rearranged the bodies, made a little more room. But that, too, couldn't be. They never came back here without him. He saw Christina Barnes's blonde hair leaking out from beneath the edge of her sheet.
just a second before the sheet had been tucked securely around her head. He backed away toward the cell door, now absolutely unable to stand so near the body of Christina Barnes, and when he had reached the threshold of the cell, looked wildly around at the other bodies. They all seemed subtly different, as if they'd moved an inch or so, rolled over, and crossed their legs while his back had been turned. He stood in the entrance to the cell, now unpleasantly conscious that his back was turned to all those other bodies, but unable to stop looking at Christina Barnes. He thought that even more of her hair was frothing out from beneath the sheet. When he glanced at the little form on the cot, Hardesty's stomach slammed up into his throat. As if the dead child had wriggled forward in its sheet, the top of its bald, round head protruded through an opening in the sheet, a grotesque parody of birth. Hardesty jumped backward out of the cell into the dark corridor. Though he could not see them moving, he had a wild, panicky sense that all of the bodies in the cells were in motion, that if he stayed back here in the dark a second longer, they would point toward him like the needles of a dozen magnets. From an end cell, one he knew was empty, came a dry, rasping, voiceless sound. A chuckle. This empty sound of mirth unfolded in his mind, more a thought than a sound. Hardesty backed nervelessly down the corridor until he thumped into the edge of the metal door, then whirled around it and slammed it shut. Edward's Tapes. 12. Don leaned against the window, looking anxiously toward Haven Lane. They should have arrived 15 or 20 minutes earlier, unless Sears was in charge. If Sears had insisted on driving, Don had no idea how long the journey from Ricky's house would take. Crawling at 5 or 10 miles an hour through the streets, risking collision at every intersection and stoplight. At least they could not be killed going at Sears's speed. But they could be isolated, away from what they assumed was the safety of Ricky's and his uncle's houses. If they were out there alone in the snow on foot, their car off the road, Gregory could close in, talking amiably, waiting until they moved or ran. Don turned from the window and said to Peter Barnes, "Want some coffee?" "I'm fine," the boy said. "Do you see them coming?" "Not yet. They'll be here." "It's a terrible night, the worst yet." "Well, I'm sure they'll be here soon," Don said. "Your father didn't mind your leaving the house on Christmas Eve?" "No," Peter said, and looked truly unhappy for the first time that night. I guess he's mourning. He didn't even ask me where I was going." Peter kept his intelligent face steady, not permitting his grief to demonstrate itself in the tears Don knew were close. Don went back to the window and leaned forward, pressing his hands on the cold glass. "I see someone coming." Peter stood up behind him. "Yes, they're stopping. It's them."
"Mr. James is staying with Mr. Hawthorne now?"
"It was their idea. We all felt safer that way." He watched Sears and Ricky leave the car and begin to fight their way up the walk.
"I want to tell you something," Peter said behind him, and Don turned to look at the tall boy. "I'm really glad you're here."
"Peter," Don said, "if we get these things before they get us, it'll be mostly because of you."
"We will," Peter said quietly. And as Don went to the door, he knew that he and the boy were equally grateful for each other's company.
"Come in," he said to the two older men. "Peter is already here. How's your cold, Ricky?"
Ricky Hawthorne shook his head.
"Stable. You have something you want us to listen to?"
"On my uncle's tapes. Let me help you with your coats."
A minute later, he was leading them down the hall.
"I had quite a struggle to find the right tapes," he said. "My uncle never marked the boxes he kept them in."
He opened the door to the office. That's why the place looks like this. Empty white boxes and spools of tape covered the floor. Other white boxes littered the desk. Sears knocked a spool of tape off a chair and lowered himself into it. Ricky and Peter sat on camp chairs against a book-lined wall. Don went behind the desk. I guess Uncle Edward had some sort of filing system, but I never found out what it was. I had to go through everything before finding the more tapes. He sat down behind the desk. If I were another kind of novelist, I'd never have to dream up a plot again. My uncle was told more dirt off the record than Woodward and Bernstein.
At any rate, Sears said, extending his legs deliberately to push over a stack of white boxes. You found them, and you want us to listen to something. Let's get to it.
Drinks are on the table, Don said. You'll need it. Help yourselves. While Ricky and Sears poured whiskey for themselves and Peter took a Coke, Don described his uncle's taping technique. He just let the recorder run. He wanted to get everything the subject said. During the formal taping sessions, of course, but also during meals, having drinks, watching television, to catch anything the subject came up with. So, from time to time, the subject would be left alone in a room with a tape recorder running. We're going to listen to a couple of moments when that happened. Don swiveled his chair around and pushed the on button of the recorder on the shelf behind him. This is set just about on the right spot. I won't have to tell you what to listen for. He pushed the play button, and Edward Wanderley's voice filled the room, floating down from the big speakers perched up behind the desk. So he beat you because of the money you spent on acting lessons? A girlish voice answered.
No, he beat me because I existed.
How do you feel about it now?
Silence for a time. Then the other voice said,
Could you get me a drink, please? It's difficult for me to talk about this.
Sure, of course, I understand. Campari soda?
You remembered. Lovely.
I'll be right back.
Noises of the desk chair squeaking, footsteps. The door closed. In the few seconds of quiet which followed, Don kept his eyes on Sears and Ricky. They watched the spools of tape hissing through the heads.
Are my old friends listening to me now?
It was another voice, older, brisker, drier.
I want to say hello to all of you.
It's Eva, Sears said. That's Eva Galley's voice.
Instead of fear, his face showed anger. Ricky Hawthorne looked as if his cold had just grown much worse.
We parted the last time we all met so ignominiously that I wanted all of you to know that I remember you very well. You, dear Ricky, and you, Sears, what a dignified man you became. And you, handsome Lewis, how lucky you are to be listening today. Haven't you ever wondered what would have happened if you had gone into the girls' room instead of letting your wife answer her call? And poor, ugly John, let me thank you in advance for having such a wonderful party. I am going to enjoy myself enormously at your party, John, and I am going to leave a present behind, a token of future presence to all of you.
Don took the reel off the recorder, said, Don't say anything now. Listen to the next one first. He put on a second reel and advanced it to a number he had written on a pad. Then he pushed the play button again. Edward Wanderley.
Do you want to take a break for a little while? I could make us some lunch.
Please, don't worry about me. I'll just stay here and look at your books until everything's ready.
After Edward left the room, Eva Galley's voice came again through the speakers.
"Hello, my old friends. And are you joined by a young friend?"
"Not you, Peter," Don said. "Me."
"Is Don Wanderley with you?" "Don, I look forward to seeing you again, too. For I will, you know. I will visit each of you and thank you in person for the treatment you gave me some time ago. I hope you are looking forward to the extraordinary things in store for you."
Then she paused, using the spacing of the sentences to form separate paragraphs.
"I will take you places where you have never been. And I will see the life run out of you. And I will see you die like insects. Insects."
Don switched off the machine. "There's one more tape I want to play, but you can see why I thought you ought to hear them." Ricky still looked shaken.
She knew we were all going to sit here and listen to her, to her threats."
"But she spoke to Lewis and John," Sears said. "That's rather leading."
"Exactly. You see what that means? She can't predict things. She can just make good guesses. She thought one of you would go through these tapes shortly after my uncle's death and stew over them for a year until she celebrated the anniversary of Edward's death by killing John Jaffrey. Obviously, she thought you would write to me and that I would come out to take possession of the house. Of course, putting my name on that tape meant that you would have to get in touch with me. It was always part of her plan that I come here."
Ricky said, "As it was, we stewed pretty well on our own. I think she caused your nightmares. Anyhow, she wanted all of us here so that she could get us one by one. Now I want you to hear the last tape."
He removed the spent reel from the machine and took up the third reel beside him and placed it on the recorder. A lilting southern voice came through the big speakers.
"Don! Didn't we have a wonderful time together? Didn't we love each other, Don? I hated leaving you. Really, I was heartbroken when I left Berkeley. Do you remember the smell of burning leaves when you walked me home and the dog barking streets away? It was all so lovely, Don. And look at what a wonderful thing you made of it. I was so proud of you. You thought and thought about me, and you came so close. I wanted you to see. I wanted you to see everything and have your mind open up to all the possibilities we represent. Right through the stories about Tasker Martin and the XXX.
He switched it off. "Alma Mobley," he said. "I don't think you have to hear the rest of it." Peter Barnes stirred in his chair.
"What's she trying to do?"
"To convince us of her omnipotence. To get us so scared that we'll give up." He leaned forward over the desk. "But these tapes prove that she's not omnipotent. She makes mistakes. So her ghouls can make mistakes. They can be defeated."
"Well, you're not Canute Rockne, and this isn't the big game," Sears said. "I'm going home. To Ricky's home, that is. Unless there are other ghosts you want us to hear?"
Surprisingly, Peter answered him.
"Mr. James, pardon me, but I think you're wrong. This is the big game. It's a stupid term, and I know that's why you used it. But getting rid of these horrible things is the most important thing we'll ever do. And I'm glad we found out that they can make mistakes. I think it's wrong to be sarcastic about it. You wouldn't act like that if you ever saw them. If you ever saw them kill someone."
Don waited resignedly for Sears to crush the boy, but the lawyer merely drained his whiskey and leaned forward to speak quietly to Peter.
"You forget. I have seen them. I knew Eva Galley,
and I saw her sit up after she was dead. And I know the beast who killed your mother and his pathetic little brother, the one who held you and made you watch. I knew him, too. When he was merely a retarded schoolboy, I tried to save him from Gregory, just as you must have tried to save your mother. And like you, I failed. And, like you, I am morally offended to hear that creature's voice in any of her guises. I am morally outraged to hear that preening voice. It is unspeakable that she taunts us in this way after what she has done. I suppose I meant only that I would be more comfortable with some specific action. He stood up. I am an old man, and I am accustomed to expressing myself in whatever manner I please. Sometimes I fear I am rude. Sears smiled at the boy. That, too, might be morally offensive. But I hope that you live long enough to enjoy the pleasure of it. If ever I need a lawyer, Don thought, you're the one I want. It seemed to have worked for the boy as well.
I don't know if I'd have your style, Peter said, returning the old man's smile.
And so, Don reflected after everyone had left, the voices on the tapes had failed. The tapes had drawn the four of them even closer together. Peter's comment to Sears had been expressed in an adolescent fashion, but it had been a tribute all the same, and Sears had shown his enjoyment of it. Don went back to the tape recorder. Alma Mobley lay within it, trapped on a few spools of coated amber stuff. Frowning, he pushed the play button. Silky at first, sunny, her voice resumed.
And Alan McKechnie and all the other stories I used to hide the truth from you. It's true, I did want you to see. Your intuition was better than anyone else's. Even Florence DePizer became curious about you. But what good would it have done? Like your Rachel Varney, I have lived since the times when your continent was lighted only by small fires in the forest, since Americans dressed in hides and feathers. And even then, our kinds have abhorred each other. Your kind is so bland and smug and confident on the surface, and so neurotic and fearful and campfire-hugging within. In truth, we abhor you because we find you boring. We could have poisoned your civilization ages ago, but voluntarily lived on its edges, causing eruptions and feuds and local panics. We chose to live in your dreams and imaginations, because only there are you interesting. Don, you make a grave mistake if you underestimate us. Could you defeat a cloud, a dream, a poem? You are at the mercy of your human imaginations, and when you look for us, you should always look in the places of your imagination, in the places of your dreams. But despite all this talk about imagination, we are implacably real, as real as bullets and knives. For aren't they too tools of the imagination? And if we want to frighten you, it is to frighten you to death. For you are going to die, Donald. First your uncle, then the doctor, then Lewis, then Sears, and after Sears, Ricky. And then you and whomever you have enlisted to help you. In fact, Donald, you are dead already. You are finished. And Milburn is finished with you. Now the Louisiana accent had vanished. Even femininity had gone from the voice. It was a voice with no human resonance at all. I am going to shatter Milburn, Donald. My friends and I
will tear the soul from this pathetic town and crush its bare bones between our teeth."
A hissing silence followed. Don yanked the tape from the machine and tossed it into a cardboard box. In 20 minutes he had all his uncle's tapes in boxes. He carried the cartons into the living room and methodically fed all of the tapes into the wood fire, where they smoked and curled and stank and finally melted down to black bubbles on the burning logs. If Alma could see him, he knew she'd be laughing.
"You're dead already, Donald."
"Like hell I am," he said out loud. He remembered the haggard face of Eleanor Hardy, into which age had so suddenly burrowed. Alma had been laughing at him and the Chowder Society for decades, belittling their achievements and engineering their tragedies, hiding in the dark behind a false face, waiting for the moment to jump out and say boo.
"And Milburn is finished with you."
"Not if we can get to you first," he said into the fire.
"Not if this time we shoot the lynx."
Chapter 3. The Last of the Chowder Society.
Could you defeat a cloud, a dream, a poem?
Alma Mobley.
"And what is innocence?"
Narcissus inquired of his friend. "It is to imagine that your life is a secret," his friend replied.
"Most particularly to imagine it a secret between yourself and a mirror."
"I see," Narcissus said. "It is the illness for which mirror gazing is the cure."
1. Near 7 o'clock, Ricky Hawthorne rolled over in bed and groaned. Feelings of panic, of emergency, filled him, making the darkness admonitory. He had to get out of bed, get moving, to avert some terrible tragedy.
"Ricky," Stella uttered beside him.
"Fine, fine," he answered, and sat up in bed.
The window at the far end of the room showed dark gray shot through with lazily falling snow, flakes so big they looked like snowballs. Ricky's heartbeat sounded doom, doom. Someone was in terrible danger. In the instant before shooting into wakefulness, he'd seen an image and known, rendingly, who it was. Now all he knew was that it was impossible for him to stay in bed. He raised the covers and put one leg over the side.
"Was it your nightmare again, baby?"
Stella whispered hoarsely.
"No, no, not that. I'll be okay, Stella."
He patted her shoulder and left the bed. The urgency clung. Ricky slid his feet into his slippers, pulled a robe over his pajamas, and padded to the window.
"Honey, you're upset. Come back to bed."
"I can't."
He rubbed his face. Still that wild feeling trapped in his chest like a bird, that someone he knew was in mortal danger. Snow transformed Ricky's backyard into a range of shifting and dimpled hills. It was the snow which reminded him. The snow blowing through a mirror in Eva Galley's house, and a glimpse of Elmer Scales, his face distorted by an obligation to a commanding and cruel beauty, running raggedly through the drifts. Raising a shotgun, turning a small form into a spray of blood, Ricky's stomach savagely bent in on itself, shooting pain down into his bowels. He pressed a hand into the soft flesh below his navel and groaned again. Elmer Scales's farm, where the last stage of the Chowder Society's agony had begun.
"Ricky, what's wrong?"
"Something I saw in a mirror," he said,
straightening up now that the pain had dissolved, aware that his statement would be nonsense to Stella.
I mean something about Elmer Scales. I have to get out to his farm.
Ricky, it's 7 o'clock on Christmas morning.
Makes no difference.
You can't. Call him up first.
Yes, he said,
already on his way out of the bedroom, going past Stella's white, startled face.
I'll try that.
He was on the landing outside the bedroom, still with that wakening emergency sounding along his veins. Doom, doom, and was torn for a second between rushing into the wardrobe closet and throwing on some clothes so he'd be ready to leave and running downstairs to the telephone. A noise from downstairs decided him. Ricky put his hand on the banister and descended. Sears, fully dressed and with the fur-collared coat over his arm, was just coming out of the kitchen. The look of aggressive blandness, which was Sears's lifelong expression, was gone. His old friend's face was as taut as he knew his own to be.
You too, Sears said. I'm sorry.
I just woke up, Ricky said. I know what you're feeling. I want to go with you.
Don't interfere, Sears said. All I'm going to do is get out there, have a look around, and make sure everything's all right. I feel like a cat on a griddle.
Stella had a good idea. Let's try to call him first. Then the two of us will go together.
Sears shook his head.
You'll slow me down, Ricky. I'll be safer alone.
Come on.
Ricky put a hand on Sears's elbow and steered him back to the couch.
Nobody's going anywhere until we try the telephone. After that, we can talk about what to do.
There's nothing to talk about, Sears said, but sat down anyhow.
He twisted his body to watch Ricky lift the phone off its stand and place it on the coffee table.
You know his number?
Of course,
Ricky said, and dialed. Elmer Scales' telephone rang, and rang again. And again.
I'll give him more time,
Ricky said, and let it go for 10 rings, then 12. He heard it again. Doom, doom, that frantic pulse.
It's no good, Sears said. I'd better go. Probably won't make it anyhow on these roads.
Sears, it's still early morning, Ricky said, putting down the phone. Maybe nobody heard it ringing.
At 7?
Sears looked at his watch.
At 7:10 on Christmas morning? In a house with 5 children? Does that sound likely to you? I know something is wrong out there, and if I can get there at all, I might be able to stop it from getting worse. I don't intend to wait for you to get dressed.
Sears stood up and began putting on his coat.
At least call Hardesty and let him go out there instead. You know what I saw back in that house.
That is a feeble joke, Ricky. Hardesty? Don't be foolish. Elmer won't shoot at me. We both know that.
I know he won't, Ricky said miserably. But I'm worried, Sears. This is something Eva's doing, like what she did to John. We should not let her split us up. If we go running in all directions, she can get to us. Destroy us. We ought to call Don and get him to come with us. Oh, I know something terrible is happening out there. I'm convinced of it. But you'll court something even worse if you try to go there by yourself.
Sears looked down at pleading Ricky Hawthorne, and the impatience on his face melted.
Stella would never forgive me if I let you take that wretched cold outside again. And it would take Don half an hour or more to get there. You can't make me wait, Ricky.
I could never make you do anything you didn't want to do.
Correct,
Sears said, and buttoned his coat.
You're not expendable, Sears.
Who is? Can you name one person you think is expendable, Ricky?
I've lost too much time already, so don't make me hang around while you try to justify naming Hitler or Albert DeSalvo or Richard Speck or...
What in the world are you two talking about?
Stella was in the entrance of the living room, smoothing down her hair with the palms of her hands.
"Nail your husband to the couch and pour hot whiskey into him until I get back," Sear said.
"Don't let him go, Stella," Ricky said. "He can't go alone."
"Is it urgent?" she asked.
"For heaven's sake," Sears muttered, and Ricky nodded.
"Then he'd better go. I hope he can get the car started."
Sears moved toward the hallway, and Stella stepped aside to let him pass. But before he went into the hall, he turned back to look once more at Ricky and Stella.
"I'll be back. Don't fret about me, Ricky."
"You realize it's probably too late already?"
"It's probably been too late for 50 years, Sears said. Then he turned and was gone.
2.
Sears put on his hat and went outside into the coldest morning he could remember. His ears and the tip of his nose immediately began to sting. A moment later, the unprotected part of his forehead was also blazing with cold. He moved carefully down the slippery walk, noticing that the previous night's snow had been the lightest in 3 weeks. Only 5 or 6 inches of fresh snow lay on the old, and that meant that he had a good chance of being able to take the big Lincoln out onto the highway. The key stuck halfway into the lock. Cursing with impatience, Sears yanked it out and removed a glove to search his pockets for his cigar lighter. The cold bit and tore at his fingers, but the lighter snapped out its flame. Sears played it back and forth over the key, and just when his fingers felt as though they were about to drop off, slotted the key neatly into the lock. He opened the door and slid himself onto the leather seat. Then the interminable business of starting the engine. Sears ground his teeth and tried to get the engine to turn over by willing it. He saw Elmer Scales's face, as he had when coming awake, staring at him with dazed, unfocused eyes and saying,
"You gotta get out here, Mr. James. I don't know what I've been doing. Just get here, for Christ's sake."
The engine gnashed and sputtered, then mercifully caught. Sears fluttered the gas pedal, making the engine roar, and then rocked the car back and forth to roll it out of its depression and through the snow which had built up around it. After he got the car pointed out onto the street, Sears took the ice tool from the dashboard and pushed the powder off the windshield. The big, harmless fluffs of snow swirled about him in a soundless dawn. He reversed the tool and used the bladed end to clear an 8-inch hole in the ice, directly in front of the steering wheel. He'd let the heater do the rest.
"Things you're better off not knowing, Ricky," he said to himself, thinking of the childish footprints he'd seen in the drifts outside his window 3 mornings running. The first morning, he'd pulled his drapes shut in case Stella came into the guest room to clean. A day later, he realized that Stella had an extremely haphazard approach to housekeeping, and that not even bribery would induce her to enter the guest room. She was waiting until the cleaning woman would be able to come from the hollow. For 2 mornings, those prints of bare feet dotted the snow which relentlessly climbed up to the window, even on Sears's protected side of the house. This morning, after Elmer's drugged face had pulled him unceremoniously from sleep, he had seen the prints on the windowsill. How long would it be before Fenny appeared inside the Hawthorne house, trotting gleefully up and down the stairs? One more night? If Sears could lead him away, perhaps he could win more time for Ricky and Stella. In the meantime, he had to see to Elmer Scales and,
"Just get here, for Christ's sake!"
Ricky, too, had been tuned into whatever kind of signal that was, but fortunately Stella had appeared to keep him at home. The Lincoln rolled out onto the street and began bowling through the snow. There's one comfort, Sears thought. At this time of the morning on Christmas Day,
The only other person on the road will be Omar Norris. Sears pushed Elmer Scales' face and voice out of his consciousness and concentrated on driving. Omar had worked most of the night again, it seemed, because nearly all the streets in the center of Millburn were scraped down to the last 4 or 5 inches of hard-packed, frozen snow. On these streets, the only danger was of skidding on the glassy cake beneath the wheels and going off into a spin to collide with a buried car. He thought of Fenny Bate on his windowsill, levering up the window, gliding into the house, snuffling for the scent of living things. But no, those windows had storms on them, and he had made sure the inner windows were locked. Maybe he was doing the wrong thing. Maybe he ought to turn around and go back to Ricky's house. But he couldn't do that, he realized. He swung the car through the red light at the top of the square and lifted his foot from the accelerator, letting the car coast into its own angle past the front of the hotel. He could not go back. Elmer's voice seemed almost to get stronger, sounding deep tones of pain, of confusion.
"Jesus, Sears, I can't get my head around what's happening out here!"
He twitched the wheel and straightened out the car. The only rough spot now would be the highway, those few miles of treacherous hills, cars stacked up in the ditches on both sides. He might be forced to walk.
"Jesus, Sears, I can't figure out all this blood. Seems like those trespassers got in finally, and now I'm scared bad, Sears, scared real bad."
Sears nudged the accelerator down a fraction of an inch. 3. At the top of Underhill Road, he paused. It was much worse than he expected. Through the snow and gloom of the morning, he could see the red lights on Omar's plow, pushing maddeningly slowly toward the highway. A 9-foot drift, shaped like a surfer's ideal wave, curled over all the unplowed section of Underhill Road. If he tried to get around Omar's plow, he'd bury the Lincoln in the drift. For a second, he had a mad impulse to do just that. Floor the accelerator and sail down the 50 yards to the bottom of the hill, and then smash the Lincoln through the snow, crashing through it around Omar on his slow-motion throne, and exploding out of the big drift onto the highway. It was as if Elmer were telling him to do it.
"Get that car moving, Mr. James. I need you bad."
Sears blew his horn, mashing his hand down on the button. Omar turned around to gape at him. When he saw the Lincoln, he jabbed one finger in the air, and through the glass behind the cab, Sears saw him weave on the seat, his face covered with snow-crusted ski mask, and knew two things at once. Omar was drunk and half-dead with exhaustion, and he was yelling at him, telling him to turn around and not come down the hill. The Lincoln's tires would never hold on the slope. Elmer's dogged, wheedling voice had kept him from seeing it. The Lincoln, idling, rolled a few inches down the long hill. Omar switched off the plow and stood up half out of the cab, supporting himself on one of the struts to the blade. He held a hand out, palm forward, like a traffic cop. Sears stamped on his brake pedal, and the Lincoln shuddered on the slippery plowed surface. Omar was making circular motions with his free hand, telling him to turn around or back up. Sears' car lurched another 6 inches down the slope, and he grabbed for the handbrake, no longer thinking of how to handle the car, but just trying to stop it. He heard Elmer saying,
"Sears, need,
that dogged, high-pitched voice urging the car forward. And then saw Louis Benedict at the bottom of the hill, running toward him, waving his arms to make him stop, a khaki jacket flapping out behind him, his hair blowing,
Need!
Sears released the handbrake and pushed his foot down on the accelerator. The Lincoln skidded forward, its rear tires whining, and plummeted down the long hill, fishtailing from side to side. Behind Lewis's running figure,
Sears saw a blurry Omar Norris standing stock still on the snowplow. Traveling at 75 miles an hour, the Lincoln sliced through the figure of Louis Benedict. Sears opened his mouth and shouted, twisting the wheel savagely to the left. The Lincoln spun three-fourths of the way around and jolted the snowplow with its right rear fender before plunging into the huge curling drift. His eyes closed. Sears heard the mushy, sickening thud of a heavy object striking the windshield. A moment later, he felt the atmosphere about him become thicker. In the next endless second, the car crumped to a stop, as if he'd hit a wall. He opened his eyes and saw he was in darkness. Sears's head stung where he had struck it in the crash. He put one hand to a temple and felt blood. With the other, he switched on the interior lights. Omar Norris's masked face, jammed against the windshield, peered with an empty eye in at the passenger seat. 5 feet of snow held the car like cement. "Now, little brother," said a deep voice from the back of the car. A small hand, earth embedded under its nails, reached forward to brush against Sears's cheek. The violence of his reaction took Sears by surprise. He rocketed sideways on the seat, getting his body out from under the wheel without planning or forethought, moved by a galvanic revulsion. His cheek felt scraped where the child touched it, and already, in the sealed-off car, he could smell their corruption. They sat forward in the back seat, glowing at him, their mouths open. He had startled them, too. Disgust for these obscene beings kindled up in him. He would not die passively at their hands. Sears threw himself forward and grunted, aiming the only punch he had thrown in 60 years. It caught Gregory Bates' cheekbone and slid, tearing the flesh into a damp, reeking softness. Glistening fluid slid over the torn cheek.
"So you can be hurt," Sears said. "By God, you can!"
Snarling, they flew at him. 12 noon, Christmas Day. 4. Ricky knew that Hardesty was drunk again the moment Walt had finished breathing 2 words into the telephone. By the time he had uttered as many sentences, he knew that Milburn was without a sheriff.
"You know where you can put this job," Hardesty said, and belched. "You can shove it. Hear me, Hawthorne?"
"I hear you, Walt,"
Ricky sat on the couch and glanced over at Stella, whose face was averted into her cupped hands. Mourning already, he thought. Mourning because she let him go alone, because she sent him out of here, without a blessing, without even thanks. Don Wanderley squatted on the floor beside Stella's chair and put an arm over her shoulders.
"Yeah, you hear me? Well, listen, I used to be a Marine, you know what, lawyer? Korea. Had 3 stripes, hear that?"
A loud crash. Hardesty had fallen into a chair or knocked over a lamp. Ricky did not answer.
3 goddamn stripes. A leather neck. You could call me a goddamned hero, I don't mind. Well, I didn't need you to tell me to go out to that farm. Neighbor went in there around 11. Found them all. Scales killed them all. Shot them. And afterward, laid down under his goddamned tree and blew his head apart. State cops took all the bodies away in a helicopter. No, you tell me why he did it, lawyer, and you tell me how you knew something happened out there."
"Because I once borrowed his father's car," Ricky said. "I know it doesn't make sense, Walt."
Don looked up at him from beside Stella, but she merely pushed her face deeper into her hands.
"Doesn't make shit. Beautiful. Well, you can find a new sheriff for this town. I'm clearing out as soon as the county plows get in. I can go anywhere. Record like mine. Anywhere? Not because of out there. Not because of Scales' little massacre. You and your rich bitch friend's been sitting on something all along. All along. And whatever it is, does things. Meaner than a stirred-up hog, right? It got into Scales' place, didn't it? Got into his head. Can go anywhere, can it? And who called all this down on us, hey, Mr. Lawyer? You, hey?
Ricky said nothing.
You can call it animostrin, but that's just sheer plain lawyer's crap. God damn it, I always thought you were an asshole, Hawthorne. But I'm telling you now, anything shows up around here with ideas about moving me around, I'm going to blow it in half. You and your buddies got all the fancy ideas. If you got any buddies left, you could take care of things around here. I'm staying in here until the roads get clear. Sent the deputies home. Anybody comes around here, I shoot first, questions later. Then I get out.
What about Sears? Ricky asked, knowing that Hardesty would not tell him until he asked. Has anyone seen Sears?
Oh, Sears James. Yeah, funny about that. State cops found him, too. Saw his car half buried in a drift, bottom of Underhill Road, snowplow all fucked over. You can bury him whatever the hell you want, little buddy. If everybody in this goddamn freak show town doesn't end up cut to pieces or sucked out dry or blown in half. Ugh.
Another belch.
I'm pig drunk, lawyer. Gonna stay that way. Then I cut out of here. To hell with you and everything about you.
He hung up. Ricky said, Hardesty's lost his mind, and Sears is dead. Stella began to weep. Soon he and she and Don were in a circle, arms around each other for that primitive consolation.
I'm the only one left,
Ricky said into his wife's shoulder.
My God, Stella, I'm the only one left.
Late that night, each of them, Ricky and Stella in their bedroom, Don in the guest room, heard the music playing through the town. Exclamatory trumpets and breathy saxophones, the Arcadian music of the soul's night, the liquid music of America's underside. And they heard it in an extra strain of release and abandonment. Dr. Rabbitfoot's band was celebrating. 5. After Christmas, even neighbors stopped seeing each other, and the few optimists who still had plans for New Year's Eve quietly forgot them. All the public buildings stayed closed. Young Brothers and the library, the drugstores and the churches and the offices. On Wheat Row, the drifts lapped up against the facades all the way to the rain gutters. Even the bars stayed closed, and Fat Humphrey Stallage stayed in his frame house out behind the tavern, listening to the wind and playing pinochle with his wife, thinking that when the county plows got in, he'd start making more money than the mint. Nothing brought people into bars like bad times. His wife said, "Don't talk like a gravedigger." And that killed the conversation and the pinochle, too, for a while. Everybody knew about Sears James and Omar Norris, and worst of all, about what Elmer Scales had done. It seemed that if you listened to that snow hissing long enough, you wouldn't just hear it telling you that it was waiting for you. You'd hear some terrible secret, a secret to turn your life black. Some Milburn people snapped awake in the dog hours of morning, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and thought they saw one of those poor Scales kids standing at the foot of the bed, grinning at them. Couldn't place which of the boys it was,
but it had to be Davy or Butch or Mitchell, and took a pill to get back to sleep and forget the way little Davy or Butch or whoever it was looked, with his ribs shining underneath his skin and his skinny face shining too. Eventually the town heard about Sheriff Hardesty, how he was holed up in his office with all those bodies waiting in the utility cells. Two of the Pegram boys had snowmobiles, and they coasted up the door of the sheriff's office to check him out, see if he was as nutty as the rumor said. A whiskery face jammed itself up against the window as they climbed off the snowmobiles. Hardesty lifted his pistol so the boys could see it, and shouted through the glass that if they didn't pull off those damn ski masks and show their faces, they wouldn't have any faces left. Most people knew someone who had a friend who'd had to go past the sheriff's office and swore that he heard Hardesty shouting in there, yelling at nothing or at himself, or at whatever it was that could move freely around Milburn in this weather, sliding in and out of their dreams, exulting in shadows, whenever they'd just turned their heads. Whatever it was that could account for that music some of them had heard around midnight on Christmas night, inexplicable music that should have sounded joyful, but was instead wound full of the darkest emotions they knew. They pushed their heads into their pillows and told themselves it was a radio or a trick of the wind. They'd tell themselves anything rather than believe that something was out there that could make a noise so fearsome. Peter Barnes got out of bed that night, having heard the music and imagining that this time the Bate brothers and Anna Mostyn and Don's Dr. Rabbitfoot were making a special trip to get him. But there was another cause, he knew. He locked his door and climbed back into bed and pushed his hands down on his ears. But the wild music got louder, coming down his street and louder still. It stopped directly in front of his house, sliced off in the middle of a bar, as if a button on a tape recorder had been pushed. The silence was more charged with possibilities than the music had been. Finally, Peter could stand the tension no longer, and softly left his bed and looked out of his window onto the street. Down there, down where he had once seen his father marching off to work looking dumpy and Russian, stood a line of people in bright moonlight. Nothing could stop him from recognizing the figures standing on the fresh snow where the road should have been. They stood gazing up at him with shadowed eyes and open mouths. The town's dead. And he would never know if they stood there only in his mind, or if Gregory Bate and his benefactor had stirred these facsimiles and made them move. Or if Hardesty's jail and a half-dozen graves had opened to let their inhabitants walk. He saw Jim Hardy staring up at his window, and the insurance salesman Freddie Robinson, and old Dr. Jaffrey and Louis Benedict, and Harlan Bouts. He had died while shoveling snow. Omar Norris and Sears James were beside the dentist. Peter's heart moved to see Sears. He'd known that was why the music had sounded again. A girl stepped out from behind Sears, and Peter blinked to see Penny Drager, her once exciting face as blank and dead as all the others. A small group of children stood mutely beside a tall scarecrow with a shotgun, and Peter nodded, mouthing the word, "scales," to himself. He had not known. Then the crowd divided to let his mother come forward. She was not the lifelike ghost he had seen in the Bay Tree Market's parking lot. Like the others, his mother was washed of life, too empty even for despair. She seemed animated only by need, need at a level beneath all feeling. Foreshortened by his angle of vision, Christina came forward over the snow to the boundary of their property. She extended her arms up to him, and her mouth moved. He knew that no human words could have issued from that mouth, from that
driven body, it must have been only a moan or a cry. She, they, all were asking him to come out. Or were they pleading for surcease, for sleep? Peter began to cry. They were eerie, not frightening. Standing out there below his window, so pitiably drained, they were as if merely dreamed. The Bates and their benefactor had sent them, but it was him they needed. The tears cold on his cheeks, Peter turned away from the window. So many, so many, so many. Face up, he lay back on his bed, stared with open eyes at the ceiling. He knew they would go. Or would he look out in the morning to see them all still there, frozen into place like snowmen? But the music blared into life again, suddenly as present as a bright slash of red. And yes, they would be drifting away, following Dr. Rabbitfoot's bright tempo. When the music had faded, Peter got up from his bed and checked the window. Yes, gone. They had not even left marks on the snow. He went downstairs in the dark. At the foot of the stairs, saw a line of light beneath the television room door. Peter gently pushed it open. The television showed a pattern of moving dots divided by a slowly upward-drifting black bar. The strong brown smell of whiskey filled the room. His father lay back in the chair with his mouth open, tie undone, the skin on his face and neck gray and parchment-like, breathing with the soft, rattling inhalations of an infant. A nearly empty bottle, a full glass in which the ice had melted, sat beside him on the table. Peter went to the television set and switched it off. Then he tenderly shook his father's arm. His father's eyes opened, cloudy and dazed.
Pete, heard music.
You were dreaming.
What time?
Near one.
I was thinking about your mother. You look like her, Pete. My hair, her face. Lucky. Could have looked like me.
I was thinking about her, too.
His father got out of the chair, rubbed his cheeks, and gave Peter a look of unexpected clarity.
You're grown up, Pete. Funny. I saw it just now. You're a grown man.
Peter, embarrassed, said nothing.
Didn't want to tell you earlier. Ed Venuti called me up this afternoon. Heard it from the state cops. Elmer Scales, farmer a little way out of town, had his mortgage with us. All those kids? Ed says he killed them all. Shot all the kids and then shot his wife and then killed himself. Pete, this town is going crazy. Just plain sick and crazy.
Let's get upstairs, Peter said.
6. For some days, Milburn stood as still as Humphrey Stallage's card game after his wife had uttered a word which seemed obscene to both of them. Gravediggers and graves were a taboo subject. When everybody in town knew well or was related to one of the sheet-covered bodies in the jail. People settled down in front of the television and ate pizzas from the freezer and prayed that the power lines would stay up. They avoided one another. If you looked outside and saw your next-door neighbor fighting up his lawn to get to his front door, he looked unearthly, transformed by stress into a wild, ragged, frontier version of himself. You knew he'd damage anyone who threatened to